Hello and welcome to In Control, the first podcast on control theory. Here we discuss the science of feedback, decision making, artificial intelligence, and much more. I'm your host, Alberto Padoan, live from a recording studio in Zurich. Quick thanks to our sponsor, the National Center of Competence in Research on Dependable Ubiquitous Automation at ETH Zurich and the International Federation of Automatic Control. Today we're honored to host again John Doyle. John is a legendary figure in control, and he is also the Jean-Louis Chameau Professor of Control and Dynamical Systems in the Division of Engineering and Applied Science at Caltech. Without further ado, welcome back to the show, John.
Great to be back. I had so much fun last time.
So today's episode will be the second part of a longer discussion on your research. And as promised in the past episode, our followers can check the past episode on our website or wherever they find their podcast. Today, we promise to explore your research evolution from the world of robust control to the universe of complex systems and layered architectures. So essentially today, I guess we're going to try to address the question, what are you most excited about these days? But I thought, if you like, we can try to build up chronologically from where we left. So from the DGKF paper all the way to the present.
Great.
So I think, you know, having a look at your publications trajectory in preparing this episode, I saw basically a shift of focus from the 90s all the way to the 2000s, basically to complex systems, to architecture systems, possibly affected by the fact that the internet was exploding around that time. Just to set the stage, I would note it down that computer ownership in the US rose from 1990 to 1997, from 15% to 35%, as it shifted from being a luxury to a necessity, essentially. And this also marked the beginning of the information age in a certain sense. At least in terms of your research output, you've definitely focused from the DGKF paper all the way to the 2000s to, you know, making everything that you guys developed in the 80s and the 90s practical. There was a MATLAB toolbox about robust control, you know, mu analysis, the complex structure singular value with Andy Packard. But I think the first mark that I could see of you venturing in the world of networks was a 1999 paper about physics and the internet called Highly Optimized Tolerance, a Mechanism for Power Laws in Design Systems. Can you tell us a bit about what was in that paper? And I'm wondering whether that was actually the first.
There was a bunch of stuff happening around that same time. And I would say there was three threads. And we'll see why they make sense in a sort of layered architecture view. And the bottom layer is almost always physics. So in the internet, the bottom layer would be, you know, photonics and VLSI technology. So, and the top layer is something like software. Certainly in the internet, the top layer would be the application software. But then there's tons of layers in between that are typically hidden. And so what we want is what we call a full stack theory. So a theory that applies across the whole architecture so that you have a principled way of deciding what to do in what layer, how many layers should you have. And nothing like that existed. And I would say we're still working on that. I mean, I think we made huge progress in the last two decades, but very few people are working on it. And so it's progressing much more slowly than I would like. And also there were some real obstacles technically that we've only solved recently. For example, you know, the SLS framework. So my starting point was, I think, three things. One was we need a theory of the physical layer that just made more sense. And there was this huge growth in this whole area of complexity science and network science coming out of physics. It was sort of almost worse than wrong. It looked like a deliberate hoax. And there were deliberate hoaxes at the time. There was these science wars and there were deliberate hoaxes. But it looked like deliberate hoaxes in the sense that you'd make a claim about the internet that wasn't just wrong, but it was outrageously wrong. And it'd be on the cover of Nature. So you had at the one time, and let me explain from the controls point of view how you would go towards this. So what you'd find is if you're a control engineer, your job is to design an algorithm to go in some box in some big system that you don't design. You don't pick the actuators, you don't pick the sensors, you don't pick the network, you don't pick anything. All you do is put an algorithm in a box, which is an important thing to do well. We need to be able to, you know, take big systems, decompose them into boxes, and design good boxes. But we're increasingly, as we build ever more complex systems, and increasingly as we try to understand biology and medicine, it's what the boxes are and where and why is as important as the algorithms that run in the boxes. And that's architecture. And control engineers don't do that. We accept the architecture that somebody else has designed without any theory. And they're usually some artistic genius that, and the result is architectures that are incredibly fragile. And that's been always the case. So burning fossil fuels, like what could go wrong? And so most of our problems now are not because little algorithms and boxes are bad. And that was a legitimate problem in the 70s, right? There was a problem with how we were designing the algorithms that go in the boxes that were given to us. And we had to fix that. We had to make that process robust and scalable and all the things that we worked on in the 80s and 90s. But ultimately, even if you do that perfectly, I don't want to downgrade everything we do, but it almost makes no difference. Because if the overall architecture is bad, you know, then making our missiles, you know, have much smaller error in how they hit their targets is trivial compared to let's not fire those missiles at all. Let's make it unnecessary to fire those missiles. I mean, that's kind of a trivial example, but the idea is that we live in a world dominated by very complex architectures that nobody really designed. And if they did design it, there was no theory. It was mostly by evolution. Now, when it comes to, say, biology, if you believe in evolution, you think it's only evolution. There is no intelligent design. But then you'd say, oh, but engineering isn't like that. There is intelligent design. Well, there's not. There's intelligent design of parts, but there's not intelligent design of architecture. So it's an art. And on the one hand, we've had absolutely unbelievable, brilliant, artistic architects making things like the internet. But doing it without a theory means that it's going to be unbelievably fragile. So every case study we might look at, from bacteria through, say, the internet, because that's a recent phenomena, has enormous efficiencies, fantastic nominal performance, and pretty terrible robustness. And those the crashes get patched. They don't get really fundamentally fixed. Although I would say in the last decade, after I kind of dropped out of the internet, they made really fundamental changes to the architecture that were vast improvements.
It's fantastic. So with this answer, you already touched on so many issues that I hope we'll try to address adequately in this episode. So we basically started from this paper in which essentially combines these ideas stimulated from the internet exploding in the 2000s, I believe, and, you know, with these power laws that and tools that come from physics to study, I guess, complex systems. And also, I noticed that in 2000, as you mentioned also before, your interest, I don't know, at least in terms of publications, surfaces for biology with a paper called Robust Perfect Adaptation in Bacterial Chemotaxis Through Integral Feedback Control. And it seems to me that the unifying thread to both papers is that you really care about trade-offs, and you come in as a control engineer who cares about robustness in both of these type of complex systems, aiming to build a unifying theory somehow.
Yeah, so if we think about these three case studies, which is three motivating case studies, which is foundational physics, bacteria biology, which is, you know, the bacteria that transitioned from non-life to life, and everything in our world evolved from bacteria. So we want to understand that. And then the internet. So those are three, I would say, driving case studies for thinking about architecture. And so you mentioned this highly optimized tolerance hot stuff that we published in the physics literature. So the physicists had this generic mechanism to produce power laws, and it's called critical phase transitions. And the canonical model is a sand pile. So you put sand on it and you get avalanches, and the avalanches are roughly power laws. And they just thought everything was an avalanche. So the idea would be you see, and now here's the thing is you see power laws everywhere. So the large scale world is not Gaussian at all. And so everything about that in the popular literature was wrong. Everything, the statistics, the explanations, everything. Now, there were experts on power laws who were fabulous. And, you know, there's some of them are at Caltech, right? And they have written books and papers and stuff on the statistics of power laws and how you should do that. So it wasn't that you couldn't do it. It wasn't like it was unknown. It was just ignored. So in physics, you had people, because they did the statistics so badly, they would find power laws where they did not exist and then mischaracterize them where they did exist. So one of the things that just came up was, you know, theories of power laws, like why are there power laws everywhere? And the design idea is that we have a wide range of disturbance types, some very common and some very rare. In evolving systems, it's natural to devote more resources to the common perturbations. And you might devote no resources to something you've never, ever seen, like a large earthquake, you know, or you know, just big events that you just haven't seen, you know.
A global pandemic.
Yeah. So there's just tail events that you've never seen, very hard to model. Like all the tail consequences of global warming. They're horrible. But we've not experienced them before. They're not in our data. They're hard to model. And you can sort of say qualitatively what might go wrong. But the tail events in everything we're doing are really bad. And we don't know how to devote resources. So we don't. And what that does is it turns possibly exponential distributions of disturbances, where the rare events are very, very rare, into power laws, because even though the events are very rare, they're huge. That's true of forest fires, that's true of traffic in the internet, that's true of earthquakes. Basically everything out there in the world at the large scale has these power laws. And in design systems, we think there's kind of a universal mechanism, which is we don't devote resources to stopping large events, and those large events will cause cascading failures that take down whole networks. And that's true in our bodies, that's true in the internet, so, and it's true in the power grid. Power grid has power laws everywhere. So that was the physics idea, that yes, there are power laws everywhere, but no, they're not all sand piles. And that got published in the highest impact physics journals, and it was just denied, basically rejected by the mainstream in physics, just completely rejected. So that made almost no dent. And I gave up. So I just, you know, what's the point? Right. And so, and that stuff's still around. It's very popular. There's going to be Nobel Prizes for it, I'm guessing. So that's a futile effort, right? So.
Yeah, the other thread of research that seemed to have interested you and where you actually made a huge impact, from at least from what I see, at least in the records, was biology.
Yes.
In 2001, you basically devised a systems biology markup language that is extremely popular today, and it's used as the de facto, language model, in a sense, for computational biologists to share different models, if I understand correctly.
That's correctly. And that, I think that's a somewhat interesting story. And I think, of course, my role in SBML was really, really tiny. But it resulted from an architectural view. So in around that time, we were getting this, you know, Tower of Babel of biology modeling and simulation toolboxes, basically. Okay. So everybody was writing their own, and which is fine. And they had complementary capabilities and stuff. But my idea was we needed a common language to just share models, right? Just a markup language. I mean, it's a trivial idea, but you don't make markup languages for systems that don't have architecture. It doesn't make any sense to try to translate a very complex model from one area to another, if it doesn't have the kind of architecture that we see in biology with you know, DNA, RNA, proteins, metabolites, layered in an architecture of control. So bacteria in particular is a good starting point. Bacteria have an absolutely universal architecture. So bacteria are astonishingly diverse, as are, say, the apps on our cell phones, right? Both between each of our cell phones and within our cell phones, enormous diversity. That diversity, ironically, is only possible because they're shared operating systems. So you have to have, and this is sort of an hourglass, it says that there's enormous diversity in functionality and applications, a fair amount of diversity in the hardware, but there's very little diversity in the control system that maps functions onto hardware. And that's true in bacteria, it's true on our cell phones, true in the internet, true in everything. Okay. But if you have that architecture, then you can translate from one modeling infrastructure to another, but you need a you need a lingua franca, you need a universal language, and that was SBML. Now, I didn't want to work on SBML. I just had sort of the idea, and it was hatched, I don't remember what year, but maybe 1999 or something, in a bar in Tokyo. I got to be friends with this amazing guy named Hiroaki Kitano. So he was the youngest like member of the board of directors at Sony. He was the chief engineer on the Sony Dog back in the 90s. He started RoboCup. I mean, he was just a visionary. And I said to him, you know, late night over drinks in a bar in Tokyo, I said, we need SBML. And like, I didn't have to explain it to him, right? He knew exactly what was needed. And he had a lot of money. So he said, could you do that at Caltech? I said, yeah. And he gave me I think the biggest grant I've ever gotten to put together a team. And I just got a great team, right? Just find who are the best people who could work on this, who want to work on it. And then you just let them go and get out of their way. So my contribution was really quite limited, but I think essential. Somebody had to do this, right? And why me? Well, it's just because I understood what was needed before others did, but I wasn't going to do it, right? I didn't write hardly any code for their bus control toolbox. You know, that was Andy and Gary, right? So I'm good at starting things. I'm not very good at finishing it. But SBML is a good example of an architecture-driven decision to develop software.
Yeah, that I see as the inception almost of or 20 years back, or even a bit more than that,
yeah,
of your venture into this world, together, of course, with your interest with the internet and physics.
Yeah. So, and the idea was I was kind of opportunistic in the sense of looking for gaps in understanding and try to fill them. And that was, I would say, moderately successful in biology. It had some impact. And I have a lot of papers. Some of my most highly cited papers are on the architecture of biology. The biggest impact was internet, but that's because, not really because of me, but because of the colleagues I worked with.
And I guess there you're referring to the at least one paper that I noted down to prepare the show notes was Internet Congestion Control, 2002, together with Stephen Lowe.
Yeah. Internet Congestion Control, Internet Topology, and also just kind of thinking about internet architecture. How can you formalize layered architectures as solving an optimization problem? So there was a whole bunch of stuff like that. And again, there I was fortunate that there were people for every single bit of my interests in the domain who were, you know, way better at it than me. And I was kind of the guy that was trying to pull things together, you know, connect different parts of this problem. And also it involved developing new math. All of this at some point, there's going to be a gap in what math we have. And then that's when, for me, the fun begins, right? The fun is really as much, it's very frustrating to get started in all this because you're trying to tell people something that they just don't get or disagree with. But once you can kind of get some foothold, then they say, okay, what do we do next? Well, I say, well, I got to do all this math. And then for me, that's when the most fun begins, which is to try to fill in the gaps in the math necessary to enable this architectural view. And what's the controls community should understand is it's all controls. So architecture is not about communication or computing. Those are components. Architecture as a whole is always about control. And we're the community that has seemed to least embrace that. So you have people in computing that think of themselves as architects, and then you have people who are in communications that think of their architects. But there's nobody in controls other than, say, me, who thinks, oh, no, I really am working on architecture. And we've got to change that. It's urgent that we change that, because only, I would say, and again, this is a sort of narrow view of it, but only a robust control view of architecture is going to fix all of this. And now when we're getting just an elaboration of the available layers, particularly our connections with machine learning, I think are going to be really crucial. But if we don't have an architectural view of what happens when you add learning as a layer on top of control, it's going to be a disaster. And our bodies are highly organized so that the what we can do consciously in cortex is very limited. Like, we just can't accidentally stop our heart. So these layerings, not only do they enable, but they also restrict, so that you are restricted to do things that aren't going to crash the whole system. Just because lower layers are hidden, virtualized, but you've got to make that virtualization, and this is a lot of the content of this stuff, which is you got to make that virtualization produce safe systems. And that's still a huge, huge challenge.
Yeah, building up to actually architectures, I guess here we're navigating in the years 2000s. Just a quick comment about what you stated before. It reminds me very much of a quote from Kuhn, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. He says, scientific revolutions are inaugurated by a growing sense, often restricted to a narrow subdivision of the scientific community, that an existing paradigm has ceased to function adequately. And it seems like you've lived that experience multiple times in many domains. And from 2002 and, you know, this area of biology, you then move, you spawn in many directions, at least what I see through my notes. So you start thinking about fire in the Earth system, 2009, turbulence, 2010, sepsis, 2012. So really branching in many conceivable areas of science. And then I see in 2012, 2013, the inception of SLS and almost the first formal steps towards a theory of architectures from my humble perspective, with a couple of papers by Nikolai Matny and Lampersky as well, on optimal distributed LQG state feedback with varying communication delays and H2 control problem for decentralized systems with delays. Am I correct in this reading, or do you have anything to add?
Yeah, so I can sort of restate that a little bit with, you know, a little sharper, which is starting in 2000 and then really well on its way in by 2005, I would say, we had this view of architecture with fairly broad applications. So one of the interests, I mean, so I would say one of my interests here very much, you know, starting in the late 90s and early 2000s, turned to earthquakes and wildfires, more wildfires, but it's sort of, I always said earth, air, fire, and water, all the things that can kill you in LA. and I did work a little bit on, you know, pollution, but mostly the big thing I worked on was wildfires. And the stuff on earthquakes was just that they were doing the statistics wrong. So they had some very strange conjectures that I heard. I was in a meeting of, you know, a earthquake meeting, and they were debating something. And I just realized, oh my God, they're the only reason this debate exists is because they've been doing the statistics wrong. And so we wrote a paper, and it got published in the main geophysical journal. And the nice thing is there, that just ended things. Like right away, everybody's going, oh, that's right. Okay, we'll use the statistics. And then we don't have to quit. We don't have to fight over this stupid thing anymore. And they just quit, right? They just stopped fighting over something that was just an accident of bad statistics.
What were they fighting on, just for the audience?
So the idea is that, is there a thing called a characteristic earthquake? So if you look at the statistics and you plot them wrong, or you do the statistics wrong for sort of the size of earthquakes, you get this Richter law, which is a power law. But it has a bump in the tail. So it doesn't go straight. It actually bumps up a little bit in the tail. There's an extra large earthquake that seems to be anomalous. And there were theories mechanistically as to why that might happen. And there was a big debate about it. And it turned out that bump was just a property of the statistics of power laws. It turns out it had nothing to do with anything physical. And so once we explained that the kind of power laws that Richter predicts will always have that bump, and that bump is just a property of the statistics, it isn't a property of any underlying mechanism, then people could refocus. And then once they had a correct view of the statistics, they could have a new invigorated debate over the very largest earthquake, because it is possible that very, very large earthquakes do involve different mechanisms than small ones. That's a very legitimate question. But now you are homed in on what the real question is and not distracted by the fact that you just made a statistical error. So that was what I did. And that was just a one-off, right? I mean, I happened to be in a meeting. I saw this thing and I said, oh, this is broken. We can fix this. And that was pretty well accepted, got published in the, you know, the important journals. But it sort of almost had a trivial impact because everybody just goes, oh, yeah, oh, that's trivial. We can fix that, and moved on, right? So it wasn't like some thunderbolt or anything. So that was the earthquakes. But and then the fire stuff was just fascinating to understand the nature of wildfires in California, which are very important and are just all hell was breaking loose.
What was the conclusion of that paper, of the paper that you just mentioned on fire in the Earth system?
Oh, well, that was a science paper that just came out of a large workshop of people who were on the expert side and nobody from the sandpile side. And they invited me just because we'd written a lot of papers on, up to that point, on the dynamics of wildfires. And what we were interested in is really what's the long-term consequences of fire policy. So on the landscape, on the vegetation, on human interaction with that vegetation, how should you even think about that? And again, you see power laws everywhere. But why are there power laws there? Well, there's two sources of design in some sense. There's the vegetation itself, which promotes the power laws, it turns out. Essentially, evolution has evolved to create those naturally. But then humans shift everything. So the power laws that humans induce are very different than the ones that exist naturally. And if you don't understand that difference, if you think it's all just sand piles, I mean, you're hopelessly lost. So what we just tried to do is put together a framework that said, okay, here is the natural vegetation and the natural wildfire system. And here's how humans' intervention have changed all that. And it was all just math models and theory, right? But the people who actually were in the trenches go, oh, hey, that makes sense, right? So we made friends with the people who were really worried about policy. And that paper in Science was, in some sense, the final stage in all of this stuff. And so for me, and that was just looking at fire historically, humans and fire, you know, throughout human history, right? And that was very broad view. And I contributed, you know, there was 50 co-authors on the paper or something. So I contributed just a tiny bit.
I think so far we've covered a lot of ground, like thinking about the many science areas that you've wandered through. Before we actually talk about architectures, I'm just out of curiosity, I'd really like to talk about sepsis. So the paper that you wrote titled Something Old, Something New and a Systems View on Sepsis. Basically just the main points of that paper, if you wish, and then we can actually try to disentangle this theory of architectures and layers.
Yeah, okay. I'll put that sepsis paper in a little broader context, which is our immune system is very complex and poorly understood, but it is a layered architecture. And the key thing is you have mechanisms that are fast but inaccurate. So if you get an infection or a wound or the beginning of cancer or anything, there is very fast reactions, but they're sloppy. They're inaccurate. They can attack healthy tissue. They can miss pathogens or tumors. I mean, so it's sloppy. And that's the theme you're going to see throughout, which is we have lower layers stuff sitting on top of the physics. It's fast but inaccurate. But then there's layers and layers and layers on top of that that increase the targeting but are slower and later coming. And what happens is, and this is another extremely important feature of these layered architectures, is that they have intrinsic fragilities that are a consequence of layering. So one of those is sepsis. Another one is cancer. And these are situations where the immune system gets confused and it basically kills you, or your body kills you, by turning the architecture against itself. And that's one of the unavoidable fragilities of these layered architectures. And if you don't know that and anticipate it and mitigate it, they are disasters. So a lot of our architectures now have sepsis-like or cancer-like hijacking of them. And without the appropriate mitigating factors, we're helpless. And that's true of almost all of our big architectures. And none of them are sustainable. None of them are robust. And we're just going to, you know, ping pong around between disasters until it's all gone, right? And it's going to get worse and worse and worse. So even if you build the most robust architecture for right now, and I would say the bacterial biosphere is the perfect example of like an unbelievably robust, evolvable architecture because it turned into everything around us. But bacteria also have extreme fragilities. And that's actually an important story. And it's not a long story. And we probably maybe should to talk about that at some point. So, but the idea here is that you have these intrinsic fragilities. And if you don't have a theory of architecture, you don't anticipate them. Just like you would if you'd used LQG to design all your control systems, you might create extremely fragile things that you knew nothing about. And you check loop at a time and never see it, right? I mean, we're familiar with that from the 70s. Well, now that's the same thing writ large on a large scale. And what we learned in control theory is that putting feedback around a system to make it robust is subject to conservation laws. So you know you create fragilities. My first papers in biology were just telling biologists that in these big complex systems, there were conservation of robustness laws that were every bit as important as conservation of energy and materials, which has caught on to some extent. So there's some people who now, you know, sort of think that way. But in architecture, it's the same thing. We want architectures to be efficient. So we want to make electricity in a sustainable and renewable way. We want to transmit that electricity to our homes, you know, all that stuff. We want that to be efficient, but we also need it to be robust. And making it efficient makes it fragile. And we've got to have systematic ways for understanding those trade-offs. And that's what I've been trying to develop, both the systematic ways to look at those trade-offs in all these systems, but then also build the math to design good systems that achieve as good as you can get. And that's what we do in control, right? We don't say Bode integral formula constraints on robustness goes away because we use some new machinery. What new machinery does is let us shape that trade-off ever more rigorously and ever more targeted to the robustness we really need in the real world. And that's what we have to do with architecture. And again, like I'm the only guy working on it. So I'm partly, you know, proselytizing. I'm trying to get other people interested in this problem. And there are people in domains that are interested in this problem. So a good example is my colleague at Caltech, who Stephen Lowe, who really was, for me, everything in the internet. And there was other colleagues like Walter Willinger, who were also important in that. But domain experts who totally are into this, right? Stephen has shifted to power systems, but again, from a very architectural view. But those are very much domain specific. And it would be legitimate to say, come on, there's no theory of architecture. Too much diversity. Go, no, actually, the reason you have these complex architectures is to support enormous diversity. So when you see diversity, you know that architecture is important, even though it might be hidden. And those are all the key ideas.
You're serving me a great assist to actually move on to the theory of architectures.
Yeah.
Just add a quick comment on sepsis itself. For those who don't know, it's essentially a clinical syndrome caused by microbial infection that triggers a multi-system response.
Let me say just one thing about that, because it's a classic example. So, and I'll grossly oversimplify what sepsis is, but it captures, I think, the essence of it is, if for some reason or another, certain components that make up bacteria, like lipopolysaccharides in the cell wall or the cell membranes, okay, if those are detected in your bloodstream, it's taken as a sign that you have bacteria in your bloodstream. If you have bacteria in your bloodstream, that's essentially a death sentence. So what happens is the bacteria actually doesn't kill you, usually. What kills you is your immune system freaking out and overreacting to just the presence of molecules that suggest that there's a bacteria there. So if you get septic and you're in the intensive care unit, and I've actually done that, so I know what that's like. I don't recommend it. This happened after the Panama incident. So what happens is the doctors are mostly, they're fighting your body as much as they're fighting the bacteria, because it's a rare event. And in this case, we overreact. But there's no way you could build a system that would just go, oh, okay, some lopy polysaccharides are in my blood, no big deal, right? It's just very hard to sense the distinction between some part of a bacteria being in your bloodstream and having whole bacteria, because all you can sense is the parts anyway.
How does one actually fight sepsis medically?
Well, now you're off my expertise, but I can sort of say, although the doctors really get annoyed when I answer questions like this, as they go. They go, look, he was really helpful on the theory, but don't ask him clinical questions, right? But what you have to do is you have to both get rid of the bacteria and turn off the immune system. But you can't completely turn it off, because your immune system is what's going to kill the bacteria. So it's this very delicate dance of helping the immune system kill bacteria if they're present and shutting off the reaction or the overreaction to the components of possibly dead bacteria, usually dead bacteria, that are triggering this huge response. So it's a difficult clinical problem. And so what you want is somebody who's, what you need is an artistic genius, because, you know, we don't have the theories and methods to make this more rigorous, right? And so if you're in that situation, the quality of the physicians is going to make a huge difference.
It seems like it's almost a difficult control problem.
Incredibly difficult control problem.
So maybe this is actually a good stage to start talking about architectures. We mentioned so many examples that essentially you went throughout this 20 years journey.
Yeah.
So I guess we could start with the what, why, and how. So what is this theory of layered architectures? Why do we need it? And how do we actually formulate it and or apply it?
Okay. So there's a bunch of shockingly universal features of these architectures. And it's natural to start with why you want these, but it's hard to say why until you say what in some sense. I don't know what you do first, right? And there's another challenge here, which is for me, there's three parts of this in some sense. There is the ultimate goal, which is to have an impact on the real world. An intermediate goal is to develop the math to make that possible. And those are, you know, there's a back and forth there. But then there's an initial thing, which is if you're talking about this to someone who doesn't know either the theory or the case studies in any detail, then you got to explain to them what is architecture, even what the basics are, and what's the language. And there isn't a language. So what you have to do is you have to go around to all the places where architecture is done well and try to figure out, pull the best language out of each one of these and put it together, which I've tried to do. But the problem is nobody is consistent. So you end up with terms that in the internet mean exactly what you mean, but in actual law, like law is practiced in courts and stuff, it means something completely opposite. And then it also might mean something completely opposite to somebody who does buildings. You know, so there isn't, I'm trying to create a universal architecture, but it doesn't exist because every term I use is used contradictorily in some domain. So what I've tried to do is get a consensus. And we keep seeing layers. So layers for me is just what the internet people mean by it. But you might say, okay, I don't know how the internet works, sorry. So you say, okay, it's exactly what we mean by layers in clothing. We layer clothing. We stick garments on top of each other. So that kind of layering is maybe the most important thing about architecture. And one of the consequences of that is that you don't see the hidden layers. There's intermediate layers. Because if you put a, you know, something close to your body that's, suppose you live in Zurich and not LA, and it's the winter, you're going to put something close to your body that's soft and feels good on your body. You're going to put something external to the environment when you go outside that is weatherproof. And you would not want to reverse those. They got to go in that order, right? And then you're going to stick something in between that's warm. So you have three layers. You have a soft layer, you have a warm layer, and you have a harsh layer. And you have to do it in that order. And those are layers. And that's exactly what we mean by layers. So that's a universal. Okay. Now, the next thing you have to understand is what levels are. And that's an orthogonal concept. Again, in the clothing case, each of those garments is made up of cloth, which is made up of thread, which is made up of fibers, and eventually you're down to molecules and subatomic particles. Physics has levels, but does not have layers. There's no layers in physics. But there are levels, right? So physics is all about levels. These are orthogonal ways of decomposing something. So if I hand you a big system, you can break it. What you'll typically do is you'll break it into some parts, and that's levels. But then those parts may be organized in layers. So in the clothing example, you have a garment, or you have an outfit. In this case, outer, mid, inner layers. But you might just pull that apart and say, okay, I have three components. You go, no, but it's not just any three components. It's three components layered in a particular way. So the levels decompose, and then the layers tell you how those decomposed components are assembled to create the whole. So it tells you how the garments are organized to create an outfit. And most ways of organizing garments don't work. So if you have a closet full of garments and you pick them at random and you put them on at random, there's zero chance you'll get a functional outfit. No chance. Yet children can learn to do that, right? So there's sort of a syntax there that you learn. Okay. So laws and layers are the most important things. The next thing is diversity. Why do you bother? Well, because you have this enormous diversity in your closet. You have enormous diversity in apps on your cell phone. You have enormous diversity of ideas in your head. Bacteria have an enormous diversity of proteins that they make and an enormous diversity of things they can eat. So you've got to manage that diversity. And that diversity doesn't map onto hardware in any neat way. So your email on your phone doesn't have an email chip. Now it turns out there's parts of biology that basically say that they do think it's an email chip, because what they'll do is they'll run email, and then they'll run Word, and then they'll run PowerPoint. And when they run email, this particular chip lights up and they say, oh, that's an email chip. Because we don't see it doing anything in Word and PowerPoint, right? So, and then you go, no, in a layered architecture, that's most likely to be your internet interface. So it lights up not because it's unique to email, it's just unique to something in, that you have to send packets. So try something else, run Zoom, and you'll see the same thing light up. And that's, most of my papers in biology have been like that, to say, oh no, here's how the architecture says it has to be this other way, not this way, right? So those are layers and levels and diversity. And the next thing I think is what we call a diversity-enabled sweet spot. So the idea is that what you do is within each layer you have diversity. So for example, you have diverse hardware, you have diverse software, and either one by itself is useless. But if you take the diverse software, diverse apps, which we can swap and trade and do all sorts of stuff with, and then you have diverse hardware, now they don't map neatly onto each other. There isn't an email chip. There isn't a Word chip, right? There's diversity in both places. What you need is an architecture that maps those diversities in a way that's functional. And it's all hidden, so we can happily use your cell phone and have no idea what an operating system is. But that's the next thing is, there's almost always an operating system that connects the high layers with the low layers in a flexible way. And that's not diverse, it's universal. So bacteria have an operating system that every bacteria does exactly the same thing. And then everything else is wildly diverse. And that sounds like a paradox. So people say there can't be anything universal because there's such diversity. And then you say, no, the universality of this architecture is because there is diversity. So this looks like an hourglass. In a sense, you have diversity on top, huge diversity on top, whether it be the function of a bacterial cell or the apps you run on your cell phone or the ideas in our heads, right? enormous diversity. Moderate diversity in the hardware. So within our brains, there's very diverse hardware, but not as diverse as, and there's very diverse hardware on our cell phones, but not as diverse as the apps. But, and I'm not talking about complexity, I'm talking about diversity. They're related, but not the same. But then in the middle, you have the operating system and there's no diversity. I mean, there's a little bit, but not much. So we have lots of different hardware lying around. We have lots of different apps we run on our cell phone, but we're all running one or two variants of basically Linux, something like that. Okay. And it's, but that's all hidden. So the most important part is just hidden from view. If you're a user, you have no idea what's there. I mean, you have to check that you're compatible with your, but you don't know what the operating system even does. But even the engineers who work on it, if you're an app developer, you need to know the interface to the operating system, but you don't need to know the details. And if you're a hardware developer, you don't need to know all the details. So it isolates not just the users from the details, but it isolates the engineers. And then who does the architecture? Well, some artistic genius who's a billionaire in Silicon Valley. And because they have no theory, you end up with horrors like social media and mental illness in adolescents, particularly girls. I mean, you just, everywhere you see, you have global warming. I mean, you have unsustainability of agriculture. You have everything around us is the consequence of these layered architectures that hide the details, and those details are killing us. So, you know, in your home, you just plug into the wall, right? You don't need to know where that comes from. And every appliance you have has the same plug. So you could imagine a world in which every appliance had to have a different source of energy, and you'd have 100 different plugs in your house, each one of them for a different kind of, but that's not how we do it, right? We have a single interface, hides all the sources. We have no idea where that power, electricity comes from. We just plug in and it works. And the consequences of that is, you know, global warming. So both the strength and power of our architectures is due to layering levels, diversity. And then there's the idea of a sweet spot. So what a good architecture does is it creates a sweet spot where all these trade-offs are balanced. And we do that a little bit. So we do that in the fact that software and hardware together do much more than hardware alone could do. And that was Turing's great insight. And Turing was one of the great architectural theorists of the 20th century, in my mind, my absolute hero of the 20th century. And what's interesting is you brought up, I mean, you had some stuff on cybernetics. Cybernetics had this vision in 1950. Didn't know what the answers were, but that was the vision. An integrated theory of control, communications, and computing in man, in humans, animals, and machines. And they were poised for fabulous. And I don't want to go into this, but cybernetics didn't die. Cybernetics was killed in numerous ways. Some directly by like killing Turing, but others more indirectly by Wiener basically destroying the field. And that's the cost of having a leader in a field that is both autistic and bipolar. I mean, we want to be kind and take care of those people, but we don't want to put them in charge. And, you know, now we put psychopaths in charge of everything, seems like. Anyway, so that's a whole nother story. But the idea is that you have these universals. And the domain experts know this, but there's no common language. And it's all about trade-offs. It's all about laws. Once you add layers and levels, you get new laws at higher layers and levels that don't have anything to do with physics. You know, you get Bode's integral Bode's integral theory. You get undecidability of the halting problem. You get all these, and they're not emergent in any sense of that word mean anything. It's all about architecture. And science doesn't have any of this. There's nothing in science like undecidability of the halting problem or Bode's integral formula. But if you don't have those, you can't understand any of biology. I mean, biology doesn't make any sense unless you understand those hard limits that come across in the higher layers and levels of the architectures. So that's the essence of it, is what are the laws governing these architectures in the higher levels and layers? What levels do you need? What layers do you need? How do you enable diversity? How do you exploit diversity? And then, you know, how do you put all this together? And how do you make it evolvable? So one of the fabulous things about these layered architectures is they're highly evolvable. Once you have a shared operating system, you can just swap in new apps, you can swap in new hardware, and they don't have to worry about the combinatorics of all the software working and all the hardware. All it has to do is talk to the operating system. So bacteria swap genes like we swap apps, And they just work right away, right? So a bacteria knows that if it gets a gene from another bacteria, most of the time it's going to at least function. It might not do anything useful, but it will at least be syntactically and semantically correct in that context so that you can take that gene, express it, and make proteins. Now, that protein might not be useful to that bacteria, but that swapping ability means the evolution of bacteria is accelerated infinitely compared to if they did not have that. Just like if we had to write all our own code for everything we do on our cell phones, nobody would use cell phones. Okay, so that's a quick rant on the basics of architecture. But it turns out everything around us has laws, layers, levels, diversity, sweet spots, everything. Why? Because we want to create diverse functionality out of diverse parts that don't match. We don't have an email chip. We don't have a baseball gene. We don't have a baseball component in our body, right? We have to do everything in our body has to be integrated in order to, say, play baseball. But it's true of everything. It's true of our cell phones. It's true of our buildings. It's true of our cities. It's true of our wardrobes. It's true of Legos. One of my favorite examples is Legos. Children can play with Legos. I have a cover of Science article, which looks like DNA, but it's actually made out of Legos. And we wrote in about how Legos have this universal architecture. You can build an incredible diversity of toys, fair diversity of parts, but there's this SNAP protocol that is universally shared. And if you don't have that SNAP protocol, you can get a protocol that's more robust, or you get a protocol that is more easy to use. But this is a sweet spot because it's robust enough that the toys hold together, but it's flexible enough that you can easily take it apart and put it back together again, right? So it's this real sweet spot. So it's a great example of architecture. But everything is, if you understand anything around us, you can see it as an example of layers, levels, laws, diversity, sweet spots. Yeah, so the problem is it's this rant that I give all the time. And what happens is even my students and colleagues, they know the rant, but they still, and I still, mix up levels and layers, right? Because the labels are kind of arbitrary. Could we have just swapped layers and levels and been okay? Yeah, probably, right? So you have these two orthogonal concepts that are nevertheless labeled arbitrarily. And it's sort of like we could have called position and velocity the other way around. It wouldn't change what's out there. It'd just be changing our labels. Or if we, said it in Latin instead of English. I mean, so these labels are arbitrary as well. And language itself has an amazing architecture that is poorly understood because the layering of it was not, mainstream linguistics focused on one layer, which is syntax, which is a little bit like focusing on the device drivers in your cell phone and say, look, everything depends on the device drivers. Well, that's true. If you take the device drivers out, the thing crashes. But it isn't true. The device drivers are everything you need to know about the cell phone. You need to know about other parts, other layers within the operating system. You need to understand the constraints on the hardware. And there's all sorts of laws and new things that you have to worry about if you think about the whole layered architecture. And linguistics has not done that. Now it can. And there are people in linguistics who have largely nailed all this, but they're kind of fringe. And so that's an area that we're really eager to pursue now. And one of my students has made a lot of progress on this. And then you're interested in how does the brain do it, right? And so how does the brain produce and consume language? But as we're talking now, this has layers, it has levels, it has diversity, it has a sweet spot, and it has all sorts of laws. And there's multiple layers. So language is a great example of a layered architecture.
This was amazing. It really set the stage for the conversation that I'd like to have henceforward.
Yeah.
I'd like to unpack a little bit every single concept that you touched on as we progress.
Yeah.
I'd like to almost be formal and rigorous with every term that you mentioned so far that I deem important.
Yes.
So the first one is the term universal law. And the way I understand it is, a universal law is something that constrains what is physically possible. Is that correct as a definition?
Yeah, and examples of that would be conservation of energy. And then there's a deeper underlying conservation of energy and matter. So energy and matter together have a conservation law. And then you can think of conservation law, and that's the lowest layer, conservation laws. Okay. And then there's further things in quantum mechanics and gravity and so on. So there's all sorts of stuff that applies to physics, and we call them laws. You have to be careful who you say that around, because if you actually say that around lawyers, they are going to sue you, because the use of law is, you know, like basically copyrighted. So if you say Newton's law, they're going to, who's this Newton guy and where can we sue him? Right. But yes, you have to be careful with this stuff. But anyway, we call them laws.
And then we have the concept of architecture, right? And architecture is something that deconstrains what is lawful in a certain sense.
That's a way of thinking about it. And I think my favorite phrase is some biologists, you know, really fabulous biologists, came up with the phrase, constraints that deconstrain. So what you do is you have all the constraints that you can't change, matter, energy, and so on, and Bode's integral formula, and the undecidability of the halting problem, and Shannon channel capacity. So you've got all these laws that have nothing to do with physics. I mean, they're kind of related to physics, but they only come up in systems of the architecture. So unless you have a plant and a controller and sensors and actuators, you're never going to ask the question of Bode integral formula, right? So
going back to the examples that we were talking about before, like Richter's law for earthquakes.
You have to be careful. That's a little different use of the word law. It's an empirical law. But what you can then do is say, oh, I'm going to accept that law as describing the properties of the southern San Andreas. And now what I want to do is build buildings that won't fall down for 100 years, right? So you start with and the constraint idea is you can't get rid of these constraints, but then you go nuts and add lots more, right? You put constraint after constraint after constraint after constraint on top of the ones that you can't do anything about. The consequence of is that at some layer, you become deconstrained. So we start with physics. We organize physics in a way that produces the hardware on our cell phones. And what you're doing is adding law after law after law, constraint after constraint after constraint, because random piles of silicon do not make a chip. So the degrees of freedom that you're constraining there is infinite, basically. You're taking a set of measures zero out of the set of possibilities. So constraint, 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 constraint. But at the end of the day, you have this device that is incredibly deconstrained with respect to the apps that can run on it. We just go to the app store, download it, and it runs. And we can do stuff like we're doing now, right? So that's a constraints that deconstrains. So you start with constraints you absolutely can't do anything about. Conservation of energy, right? You can't change that. But then you add Avogadro's number more constraints on top of that, and you yield something that is wildly deconstrained with respect to new functionality. And that's the essence of architecture. And all these other pieces are just, how do you do that? I mean, you need layers, levels, laws, you need diversity, you need sweet spots. You need stages, you need bow ties, hourglasses, all these other elaborations. But those are absolutely universal. Every one of the systems that does that well does it with those mechanisms.
When you say constraint after constraint after constraint, I guess you're thinking about layers and levels.
Yes.
And I was wondering whether we can think of levels as, you know, different spatial or temporal scales, for example.
Yes.
Whereas layers are different in a way.
Yeah, so you could think of levels as scales. I mean, not always, but usually you're taking something and you're opening the box and looking inside it and seeing what's inside the box.
We're zooming in the language of Williams, right?
Yeah, and layers are stacking boxes. So if I see a stack of boxes, I can say, oh, okay, those are layers. Then I can take a box and open it up and I'll see another stack of boxes. So first of all, that the boxes inside my box, that's levels. But then if I look inside and say, oh, are they just randomly arranged in the box or are they organized? And often they're organized in layers. So you go back and forth. You break something open to look inside, and then you find the layers and find the stack. And then you can go into those elements and break them open, and it's layers and levels all the way down. I mean, so if you start with an ecosystem, you can say, okay, the level down is organisms. Are they just randomly arranged? No, there's all sorts of layering of an ecosystem. Okay, then you say, okay, now what's about the organism? Well, we can break open the organism. It has all sorts of parts. It has a skeleton. It has a nervous system. It has a cardiovascular system. It has all these different things. Are they just randomly arranged? No, they're highly organized. And once again, they're layered. And the layers have levels, and levels have layers, and it's levels and layers all the way down. And those are orthogonal ways of decomposing things. And I've been struggling this for decades now. I mean, that paper on the cover of Science was about exactly this. But we didn't have the language to just, I mean, we just said, I forget what we said. We said there's two kinds of layers, or there's two kinds of levels, and they're orthogonal. But we didn't say, okay, we're going to settle on levels just mean this thing, and layers mean this other thing, and they're always going to be these orthogonal things, and we're never going to mix them up again. And that's pretty recent, actually. I mean, maybe 10 years.
And then the other concept that I wanted to touch on is the concept of diversity-enabled sweet spot.
That's the why.
Yeah.
That's why we build architectures.
So the PNAS paper essentially says, there's a specific paragraph that says diversity is the quote-unquote most ubiquitous rule in living systems.
Yes, that's correct. So what we want is we don't want an organism that just does one thing. An organism that can only do one thing is not going to survive. An organism has to diverse things. But it can't afford to have a different part for everything it does. It can't afford to have a running part and a walking part and a balance part. I mean, it has a diverse set of hardware. And the same with our phones. We have diversity in the hardware, but the functions we want to perform are vastly more diverse and don't map neatly onto the hardware. If it does, we're done, right? So there are systems in which you simply have a one-to-one relationship between function and, a chair. A chair, there's no software, right? There's just a chair, and it maps onto the hardware. And then you go, oh, wait a second. There's all this diversity in all the furniture in my house. Is there any architecture to that? And you go, oh, yeah, actually there is. There's the parts you build it, and then there's the syntax of what makes a possible assemblage. But then most assemblages don't do anything. So you then have to say, it needs to be functional. It has to be a chair or some kind of furniture. That's another layer. And then you could say, yeah, but that's really ugly. You go, oh, okay, so there's a whole nother layer, which is you want it to be functional and aesthetic. So there's layers and layers and layers in everything we do, right?
So I think a wonderful example that illustrates all these concepts is precisely the one that you have in this paper on PNAS. So that's a mountain biking example for those who haven't read the paper.
Yes.
And basically you identify two different types of layers. So the goal here is to go with a mountain bike at high speed on a trail.
Yeah, let's step back for a second and see what the problem is. Okay. The problem is you want a mountain bike down a twisting, bumpy trail.
Right.
Now we're going to do it in virtual reality, so you don't actually do it in physically because you kill people and stuff. So now in virtual reality, actually, we can have mountain biking trails and bumps that you could never build, right? So it's a much bigger domain, but it's also safe. So what you have to do, though, is you have to do two fairly distinct things. One is deal with the bumps, mostly through proprioception and reflexes, because you don't see the bumps. You just feel them. But the trail, you have to look ahead with vision, see ahead on the trail, and then track the trail. So you have a trail layer and you have a bumps layer. And they're actually extremely different, but they have to work together. And so what ends up happening is the layer story is you take the problem of mountain biking and you split it into two layers. You have a vision-based, conscious trail tracking layer, which we're just going to call a trail layer. And then you have an unconscious, largely automatic, reactive bumps layer. They use different sensors. They use the same actuators. They both use muscles, but they use different sensors. And they use different parts of the brain to do the processing. So those are two layers. And it's easy to put that in a virtual reality environment. You can easy to make physical bumps by having like a wheel that you're controlling have a torque in it. And then you can have just a trail you follow on a screen or in a virtual reality setting. So it's easy to build that using standard gaming stuff. And it's easy to code it up because it's just a trivial kind of video game. But you have those two layers. So that's the layers. And then the levels is, and we're going to take an extremely naive view of levels, which is, we've got these two layers and they're big chunks of the nervous system and they're built out of neurons and nerves. So let's just going to focus on nerves. So nerves are the bundles of axons that connect parts of the brain. So we're going to just going to say, okay, this all boils down to long-range connections between parts of the brain. So the limiting bottleneck here is going to be in the nerves connecting all these systems. Now, is that true? No. Well, that's roughly true. I mean, the point is, it's the simplest thing we can do that captures the levels issue. And then you can ask, what are the laws governing nerves? And so, you know, we came up with all sorts of crap that was kind of nonsense. And then we showed this to like the world expert on what nerves do, named Simon Laughlin, and he's at Cambridge. I was in Cambridge at the time. And my student who was working on this was also in Cambridge. But we showed this to Simon. We showed our model, which was a god-awful mess. We said the essence of this is bandwidth versus delay. You can have high bandwidth or low delay, but you can't have both. And that's just a property of the nerves. Sorry, right? That's it. And he goes, yes, that's the essence of the trade-off. You've got that. But this formula is ridiculous. So he said, it's way simpler than that. It's just delay and bandwidth have a very simple linear relationship. So the idea is that the rate of your bandwidth is proportional to delay. So they both go up or down. So high bandwidth, high delay, low bandwidth, low delay. And that's just a property of the nerves. So that's a law of the nerve. Now, is it exactly right? Not quite, but you just asked the world expert on that trade-off, and he says, this is pretty good. We could elaborate on it, right? Now, is it the only property of nerves that matter? Absolutely not, of course. I mean, there's all sorts of other stuff that matters, but we can start with that, right? Okay. So now we say we have this hardware in the lowest level, and that hardware has this law, R equals lambda T. Bandwidth is proportional to T, and the coefficient of proportionality depends on the sizes and the costs and everything else associated with the nerves. And we're going to assume, oh, for now, that that's lambda's fixed. So now we just have two nerves, basically, a nerve for the visual problem and a nerve for the proprioception problem. And we can ask two problems. Okay, so optimize everything now. Optimize the choice of the nerves that go in the lowest level. And there's two kinds. There's the bumps nerves and the trails nerves. And then you optimize the algorithm that's running at the controller in the high layers. So you have a bumps layer controller, and then you have a trails layer controller. And then you can abstractly propose a single controller that is an integration of the two, but might not be a solution to the individual problem. So it's possible that to get the sweet spot, ultimately, you have to redesign everything, and you actually have to sort of unlayer it, and you can't really design these layers independently. Okay, so that's a possibility. So now what you've set up is you've got constraints from the bottom, you've got constraints from the top to not crash. And then the question is, what's the optimal nerves to pick? And what's the optimal algorithms to run so that you get this sweet spot where you're fast and accurate and you don't crash, even though you have no parts that are both fast and accurate? And the miracle is, and this is a miracle, we got lucky. But it's also true about our brains, which is, what you want to do is in the bumps layer, the level below in the neurons, you want to be fast, so low delay, but also low bandwidth, so inaccurate. And that's how our reflexes work. They're fast but inaccurate. That's how our immune system works. There's the fast stuff that's inaccurate. And then the high layer trails has an accurate but slow nerve. And then both of them have just controllers in the higher layer. In the higher level that includes the two algorithms for the layers over the trails and the bumps, you just design the optimal controller. So here's the miracle. You can do all the experiments and all the math with high school students because we've simplified everything. And if you design the two separately, so you design an optimal bumps layer and an optimal trails layer, the optimal total controller is simply the combination of those two. They don't have to be retuned. So that's an amazing feature of these systems. And that's true of our brains, which is you can learn to do reflexes and you can learn to do trails. You can do the bumps and learn to do trails. And then when you go to a new problem, you don't have to redo the lower layers. So once you're an athlete, you don't have to relearn how to run every time you switch boards. right? It's just a platform on which you build. Okay. So you get the optimal controller happens to be layered, and each layer can be designed independently. And there's enormous diversity in both the functions of the bump and trail layer, but there's also enormous diversity in the hardware. And the sweet spot you create is you build a system that is both fast and accurate with parts that are not. And that's the kind of miracle. Now, the other miracle is now you can go do experiments and you can vary the problem wildly over domains that don't exist physically in the real world. So you're constrained to this very virtual software world of biking. So you can do this wild variations in all this, and people can do it, and they can learn it in like 15 minutes. So that's not a problem. It's not like real biking. And the data fits the theory as if we had kind of faked it. I mean, it fits so good, it does look faked, but it's real. So we have this perfect system, and then you can do all sorts of other ones. So there's lots of other demos that you can do. Some of them, like stick balancing, is a great one. You know, Gunter Stein did stick balancing, his original. But what he didn't do is he didn't go further into the layers and levels story that's necessary to really explain what we can and can't do. So you can take an extendable pointer, and in the paper we describe this, I think, you can do an extendable pointer, and you can vary where you look and how long the pointer is, and you get this curve of where you crash and don't crash, and you can perfectly predict it using just Bode's integral formula. And then the other thing you can do is you can stand on one leg and try to balance, which is actually not that hard. But if you close your eyes, you will wobble and fall over. Notice you oscillate before you fall. So all these stories, you can't make any sense of them if you don't think about layers and levels. You have to think about the level below and what the limits on it are, the bandwidth. And this is a shock to the neuroscience community because there's a lot of experimentalists who worry about bandwidth and delay, but all the theory has no delays in it. And what's different about biology is our computers aren't running at speed of light. So in the aerospace world, we didn't worry about the fact that the computers, you know, took some time to do computations because it was instant compared to what the plane is doing. So you have speed of light versus speed of sound, and that's a gap that's almost infinite. But in biology, the speed of the nervous system and the speed of the things you want to do with it are the same. So that creates these wild constraints that we have never seen in engineering. And that is that your communication and computing internals have hard constraints on them in terms of bandwidth and delay and speed and accuracy. And since Witzenhausen, we have known that that was hopeless.
Let's talk about what is actually Witzenhausen counterexample, just for clarity for our audience.
Okay. Yeah. So this is Witzenhausen counterexample from the 60s. And what's important in this context is that he came up with an almost trivial little problem that would have otherwise been nothing, just trivial to do, low dimensional everything, really simple. And it was like an LQG problem or something. But he then said, what if we have these two separate controllers, like trails and bumps or whatever? You have two separate controllers, and they have limited communication. And all of a sudden, this really trivial problem became impossible. God awful hard. And it stood as a challenge since 1968. And my belief was that we had to figure a way around it, but I had really accepted the idea that there was just these utter intractabilities associated with putting delays inside our controllers, not just at the interfaces, not just in the sensors and actuators, but actually inside our computers, actually inside our communication systems. I was convinced of that. But I wanted to nail it down. And so after many false starts and everything, one of my students, Mickey Wang, who was working on this, and Nikolai Motny was helping, came to me with this SLS idea. And I said, you know, again, this has happened so many times in my career. I say to the student, I can't believe it's that simple. And then they go, yeah, it is. So, you know, a lot of stuff has been like that. The whole SOS, sum of squares whole framework by Pablo was him telling me each increment of progress he made and me telling him this was complete dead end, can't go there. And then he comes back the next week and says, yeah, that was right. And here's the next thing. And I would say, no way. And he says, I'm just doing what you're telling me to do. And you just don't understand how we're going to get there. And I go, okay, good point. And he was right all along, right? And so I'm good that my students, they know I'm asking good questions, but my proximal answers are not good. But here's the basic problem with Itzenhausen. And now I can say it in a way that I think everybody will get, right? I can give you least squares problems, just linear least squares. Well, how does that scale? Well, like n cubed. So easy, right? Well, except that I can make up ill-conditioned problems that you can't solve. So if I give you a matrix to invert that's sufficiently ill-conditioned, you can't invert it numerically or reasonably. And okay. So there are hard problems like that, but you don't care. You don't. If you ask me to invert a singular matrix, the answer is the matrix is singular. Don't invert it. Change the problem. And that's the same with Witzenhausen. So Witzenhausen's answer, if you could find it, would be so horrible, you would never want to use it. So what SLS says is, let's only pursue localized, distributed, delayed, limited control systems when the result is a good control system. And you want a rigorous method for telling you when you can't do that. And when you can't do that, you just say, change the problem. You don't try to find a controller that's going to be a disaster anyway. So once you introduce this, which is a theme we call sort of complexity implies fragility, if your computations are running too long and you know there's a condition number involved, then you know you're ill-conditioned and you don't want the answer. You just want to stop and go back and change the problem. So what SLS did, which again, in retrospect, it's the by far the most significant technical thing I've ever worked on, was, and I was asking the right question, which is, let's get rid of these horrible cases in Witzenhausen. Let's find a condition number, and let's then only solve well-conditioned problems. And my bet is that we can do that, and we can do it efficiently. And then the actual way we did it was not what I expected, but was the right answer. So in SLS, what you do is you design only closed-loop quantities. So your design parameters are like EULA in the sense that you are parameterizing all controllers. But a controller, you're doing it in terms of closed-loop properties that you care about, like disturbance rejection and actuator activity, stuff that you really, really care about. And then you actually just solve for the closed loops, and you only care about good closed loops. If you can't get a good closed loop, then you have to change the question. But if you do get a good closed loop, then that closed loop, and the miracle of SLS is that closed loop immediately gives you a highly structured controller. And by structure, I mean delayed, localized, all sorts of communication and computing constraints that naturally do occur in big systems or in our brains. And then you can build a controller that respects those constraints. I still am astonished that that works. And it's really simple. It's easier to learn than anything else. I mean, it's like the easiest learn. And my students have really fleshed that out. You know, there's an MPC version of SLS or an SLS version of MPC. There's, you know, there's, we've sort of SLS'd everything. And starting with that biking game, then you start saying, how does the visual cortex actually do that? Well, it's slow and it's got all these constraints. So what architecture does the visual cortex have to have in order to do this? And you crank it through the SLS and you come out with this thing that looks like visual cortex for the first time. We have a theoretical reason why there's so much feedback. So what ends up happening is if you have delays internally, you have to have tons of internal feedback. So now we've just, you know, have a series of papers that have, you know, address that. And the thing was, without SLS, all this architecture would be, I'm not going to say pointless, but what you always end up with is the lowest layer problem being this distributed, localized sort of reflex, no global anything. And if you can't solve that lowest layer stuff, then what's the point of layering, right? And so our biology solved those problems, right? Our brain has solved those problems through evolution. But now we have a theory that both can explain why biology does it the way it does, but also why if we want to build, you know, the future smart grid, we have to do this. So that's very exciting. Now, within neuroscience, the good news is the best neuroscientist I could possibly get convinced of this is my co-author, Terry Sanowski. So he is fab. I mean, just unbelievable in every possible way. And he's on board. But now everybody in neuroscience is going, have you seen what happened to Terry? He's started working on this crap with Doyle and all about delays. We've managed to ignore delays for decades. Why do we have to look at them now, right? And so obviously not an athlete. So we're in a situation now where we now have a there are none moment with neuroscience, right? Where we say, look, the most difficult thing about sensory motor control is we're trying to take action in the world that's just as fast as our nervous system. There's no speed of sound versus speed of light separation. It's all kind of speed of sound or slower. Okay, so, and that's just a huge problem. And control theorists have had nothing to say about that forever. And now we do. But it's control theory that's going to have to deal with the limitations on computing and communication that happens in these big systems. So control theory has to embrace these architecture challenges because nobody else is going to.
I should just mention, to punctuate also what you just discussed, that this biking game is actually available online. It's available on GitHub, Doyle Lab, Wilcon. Of course, there will be a link in the description in the show notes. I've tried it myself. It's really fun.
Yeah, yeah. So you can do, anybody can do it. And you need one piece of equipment, which is a standard gaming steering wheel with a torque motor in it to give the bumps. And those cost like $200. So with a laptop and a $200 piece of equipment, you can reproduce everything. And there's, that's also, again, so lucky that we were able to squeeze something into the existing gaming systems and do everything with conventional off-the-shelf gaming systems. So that was, again, very lucky.
As another comment that was of interest to me is, of course, we've talked about extensively about this paper, diversity-enabled sweet spots in layered architectures and speed-accuracy trade-offs in sensory-motor control on PNAS.
Yeah.
But we also talked about the content, at least implicitly, of a couple of other papers, probably a few more coming up, called Internal Feedback in Biological Control, Diversity Delays and Standard Theory, and also another one called Internal Feedback in the Cortical Perception Action Loop Enables Fast and Accurate Behavior. I just wanted to dig in to that a little bit more to understand the connections with us control theorists call the internal model principle.
Yeah.
And whether do you actually see any connection in what you just mentioned before?
Well, yeah. So one thing is you see internal models everywhere. So actually my first paper was on bacterial chemotaxis. And bacterial chemotaxis has this property of perfect adaptation. And I think we shouldn't go down that rabbit hole. But the idea is that there's a ton of experimental evidence for this. And what we said was, if you have robust perfect adaptation, you must have integral feedback. That's a theorem in control theory. And so we said, there's got to be a mechanism in the bacteria that does integral control. Let's go look for it. And if you look in the models at the time, there it was. It was a process of methylation of receptor sites. So you could really point to exactly where the integral was. And that was a big breakthrough because this idea that a behavior would imply by law a mechanism was just inconceivable to scientists. Right. I mean, they just said, that's ridiculous. We know all the laws that are relevant to biology and they come out of physics. And we say, no, here's another law. And it's integral feedback, but it's also a general special case of the internal model principle. There's certain behaviors that must have internal structure. And that's scratching the surface. So what we're trying to do is really elaborate on that. So the idea is that now what we want to do is say, given the behavior we see and given the constraints on the hardware that we know are there, how must you build this system in order for it to have a sweet spot? So how must you build visual cortex if it is to play the role it has to play in sensory motor control? So it has to be fast and accurate, but you're building it out of slow, sloppy parts. And therefore, there's only one architecture that will work, provably. Here is what that architecture is. And, oh, by the way, it looks exactly like the cryptic, confusing pictures people have been making of visual cortex for decades. So it's not that people in neuroscience didn't know that there was massive amounts of internal feedback. It's just they had these kind of vague explanations. So, I mean, the one that came closest was, oh, this is doing Bayesian prediction. Well, sort of. I mean, it is in the sense that you have an image, you have a model of the world, and you do some Kalman filter update to turn that image into something actionable. So there is something like a Kalman filter in the brain, okay? But if you have to build a Kalman filter out of really slow hardware, then it doesn't look like a Kalman filter anymore. It looks like something quite exotic. But what it does look like, and you can do this with SLS, and even after once you have the SLS answer, you can sort of hack up a story that doesn't use SLS, which is what we've done. But it doesn't look at all like what you would sort of think of as a conventional Kalman filter, but you can, to a control theorist, you can have it make total sense. And now the problem is, while it does fit the neuroanatomy, it involves an explanation that the neuroscientists, the theorists, are just unwilling to accept. And the explanation is, actually, this is pretty simple, so I can tell you what it is. So the idea is that between the retina and the actionable things in motor, the retinal image doesn't tell you what to do in the world, right? It just tells you a snapshot of what one particular thing looks like. But then you have to process the hell out of that before you can do anything with that image, right? The image doesn't tell you really what the world is. It tells you some little trace of what the world is. And then you have to do all this processing to turn this image into something actionable about the world. That gives you, you know, 100 to 200 millisecond delays, huge delays. And by then, everything has changed. So you need to not only do Kalman filtering to reconcile your sensing with the actions you've taken, but the biggest thing is everything's changed since you got that snapshot. And if you don't take that into account, you're going to die. But here's the amazing thing, is most of what has changed in that 100 to 200 milliseconds, the world hasn't changed. You have. You're running through the forest, or you're turning your head, or you're saccading your eye. So most of that motion is not in the world, it's in you. And you know what that motion is. So just as in a Kalman filter, we subtract out what we know are the actions we've taken in the world, we have to extend that to all these delays within visual cortex. So you have tons of feedback into these delays, correcting for your own motion that has made, so you've got stale data, but the errors in that stale data are mostly due to your own motion, which you know and you can take out. Now, this idea sounds absolutely insane to neuroscientists. I mean, just insane, except to a few, right? So we just got lucky. First of all, there's extensive anatomy data that just fits this perfectly. So you can't argue that the physiology isn't what we say it is, right? Everybody has to agree with that. And here's the reason nobody believed this, because everybody says, no, you just don't understand neuroscience. Have you ever looked at visual cortex? It's incredibly noisy. So what you see in visual cortex is barely correlated with what's going on in the retina. It's so noisy. And it's that noise that we need to deal with, not all of this crap feedback for delays and stuff like that. It's just that the brain is really noisy. So we're saying, actually, the brain isn't noisy at all. I think the brain isn't noisy at all. It's just slow. The experiment you used to do was you'd look at the retinal image on the rat's eyes, and then you'd measure everything in visual cortex, and they're uncorrelated. So you say, God, awful and messy. Okay. A bunch of experiments have been done just serendipitously. We didn't drive these experiments. They just happened to be done. So what people did, maybe Ann Churchland at UCLA is the superstar in this area. What you do is you don't just measure what the rat sees in the retina. You measure everything, every little twitch, every little movement, everything the rat is doing. And then you correlate this god-awful noise in visual cortex, not with just the retinal image, but with all of this motor activity, and the noise goes away. It wasn't noise. It was feedback from motor. And it looks like noise because it's completely uncoordinated with the retina. So it's exactly what our theory says. Now, that stuff is really new and not necessarily widely accepted. So we've got a bunch of pieces here that are going to take some time.
It's super fascinating. I just want to dig into two more concepts and then maybe explore a few more examples, such as language and societal implications of this theory. But before we do that, I'd like to bring into the picture essentially evolution And how does this theory relate with emergentism and intelligent design? What are your thoughts there?
Yeah, so I don't believe in intelligent design. I don't think it exists, obviously. But I think the bad thing is it doesn't exist in engineering enough. So we need more intelligent design, not less. And we haven't had much, and there's none in biology. But these architectures are super evolvable. So let's take bacteria as the original kind of architecture, okay, and the most perfect architecture. Bacteria can swap genes like we swap apps. So evolution in the bacterial biosphere is infinitely faster than evolution in an individual bacteria or a bacterial lineage. So bacteria could, you know, mutate and evolve and have its offspring have these new innovations. That's so slow that I think it almost plays no role whatsoever in bacterial evolution. So somebody's got to make a new gene, but you've got 10 to the 30th copies of bacteria all cranking out new genes all the time. And once you get one, it's shared everywhere eventually, which is a nightmare for antibiotics, because once antibiotic resistance is found, you know, in some feedlot and some cattle somewhere, it's going to get everywhere. In hospitals, it's a nightmare. So what is the most powerful mechanism for horizontal gene transfer? Well, the bacteria have this whole thing that you could even think of as an internet, right? They have packets. They can package genes in those packets. Those packets can go out in the environment, survive in the environment almost indefinitely, and then get transferred to a new bacteria. It's a miracle. So they have a bacterial internet, and we don't know how that got started, but it's been there for billions of years, presumably. So what you have now is you have not only do you have evolving organisms, but the entire biosphere is evolving together. And again, we are used to that now, right? So once you have the architecture of the internet, then the evolvability of the application space goes nuts. And then when you add additional platforms that are part of the architecture, like search, again, that is further enabling. And you add something like Zoom or something like we're doing now, again, you just can add and add and add, and you don't have to do anything to the hardware. And the reason is you have shared protocols, you have a shared layered architecture, you have a shared operating system. So the shared operating system and the shared architecture is essential for evolvability. Everything that's happened since bacteria is just weaker versions of that kind of evolvability. So these architectures not only potentially give you robustness, but they give you evolvability. But, and there's a huge but here, is that fabulous little internet that the bacteria created is called phage. And they are viruses in bacteria. Presumably at one time, they were entirely beneficial. And they still are to a great extent. So the phage that moves bacteria, exchanges bacterial genes, is still beneficial. And there's other ways to transfer genes. I'm just picking the most effective one. But it's also true, depending on who you ask, between a quarter and a half of all the bacteria in the ocean, which is where most bacteria are killed every day by phage. So the phage that were presumably invented or evolved, obviously I don't mean invention in any intelligent design sense, but you can think of the bacteria as being intelligent designers of the phage. There's no God involved, but there are smart bacteria making phage that enable them to swap genes. And that eventually gets hijacked so that the most deadly thing in the world for bacteria is phage.
It's wonderful because you anticipated one question that I would have had for you. So the question of fragility. So what happens when things go wrong? And what at least interests to me is what happens when things go wrong at a societal scale? And what can we do in order to fix things in a certain sense? What can we do from the perspective of design as, you know, control designers?
Yeah, so I have, it turns out, quite extreme views on this. And I'm not going to try to articulate those views. First of all, it would get us all killed because both the left wing and the right wing hate this. One thing they would agree on is they hate each other, but they hate me more. So I won't tell you what I think the theoretical answer is. I'll just give you some data. So I gave you some data with the phage, that the phage massively accelerate evolution. That's the win. And they have now been hijacked, and they're the biggest killer of bacteria. And why don't they just kill all the bacteria? Well, that's evolution wouldn't favor that. So the phage are evolving too. So if you kill your host too aggressively, then you can't propagate the phage. But we now live in a world where it's certainly reasonable, say, that the world, the entities, and I don't even know if you call them live. I mean, it's not even clear the phage are alive, right? I mean, they're on the boundary. But if you draw the boundary on life to include phage, then they are the dominant life form on the planet by far. So we have an entire biosphere that seems devoted to the preservation and evolution of phage, whatever else we think we're doing, right? Now, that's more than a metaphor for everything else that's happening in our society. So we continually create architectural mechanisms, language, burning fossil fuels, massive agriculture. I mean, everything we're doing, right, is enhancing the evolvability and robustness of us in the short term and creating catastrophes in the long term. And some of them are physical, like global warming, but a lot of them are hijacking of these architectures, and societies have always been massive hijackings. So we live in a massively hijacked world and always have. So the question is there any alternative? So of course, there's three things, which is there a theory? I think there is. I think there can be. Does it look like anything anybody believes now? No. But that's the same as what we're doing for neuroscience or anywhere else. Or, you know, 1976 and robust control theory, right? So it's not, I'm familiar with that. Okay. But the good news is we have fantastic animal case studies. So if I were going to tell you that there's this universal architecture in every cell and we didn't know what it was, we could say, yeah, but if we just look at bacteria, a lot of that is there. Transcription, translation, metabolic systems, which have enzymatically catalyzed reaction. We could learn an enormous amount about how all cells work from studying bacteria. So the question is, do we have examples of societies that give us the same kind of encouragement that we can understand societies? And the answer is yes. So I will tell you that story, and I won't say anything about the theory. So if you take the five smartest animals on the planet, including humans, which is generous, they are chimps, elephants, bonobos, and orcas. And the last three I call the ebos, the elephants, bonobos, and orcas. And the idea is that these are as different mammals as you can get. So if you look at the tree of mammals, elephants, bonobos, and orcas are as different as they can be. They have as different a lifestyle as you can imagine. Everything about them is absolutely as far apart in the mammalian tree as could be. Yet they share an essentially identical social architecture when you look at it correctly. And so it's the same as you could have a Mac and a PC person saying, go, oh God, these two machines have nothing to do with each other. And I'm a Mac person. I would never use a PC, et cetera, et cetera. You go, yeah, but you know, they both have apps. They both have an operating system. They both have hardware. And actually they're not all that different. And you can get all the same apps to run them both. So you say, no, they really have the same architecture. So when I say these extremely different organisms have the same architecture, it's a strong statement because they are otherwise completely different and really different, way more different than a Mac and a PC, right? So then you can ask, can we describe, using layers, levels, diversity, and so on, can we describe these architectures and defer what those implications are for humans? Now, chimps and humans also have the same architecture, more or less, and it's extremely different. So these two different kinds of architectures, one chimps and humans, because we're kind of chimps with nukes. And then there's the ebos. And what's weird about it is the ebos are completely different from each other. The bonobos are essentially identical to chimps, and they're completely different architecturally. So you have the same organism with completely different architectures, and you have the same architecture running on completely different organisms. So let me just give you a few facts about the ebos. Okay, they're long-lived, and they have very elaborate societies organized in groups. And the composition of these groups actually varies quite a bit. Because one of the things they have to do is they have these big families and they have to avoid inbreeding. And so they have to have mechanisms to avoid inbreeding. And each one of them has a completely different mechanism. So all the details are completely different. But here's what they have in common. So the most glaring thing they have in common, and the one that's most sensational and the most likely to get you killed, is the males play absolutely essential roles in these societies, but no leadership role at all. Males are not involved in governing or leadership at all. They're involved. So the orcas is the most extreme example. So let me just tell you about the orcas. I could tell you a story about every one of them, but we don't have time. So let's all tell you about the orcas. Everybody lives with mom. So you stay in the pod that your mother is in. And the pod is run by like the oldest granny in the pod. And she could be as much as 80 years old. She went through menopause in her 30s. So most of her life, she has not been reproductive. So a lot of the females in the pod are post-reproductive. The reason is it's really hard to take care of baby orcas. So you need the village. So at some point, you're better off, and this is the theory, okay, not mine, the theory of people who work on orcas, that at some point, you're better off stop having your own babies, which they take forever, and switch to taking care of your children's children. And that all has this kind of pyramid structure where at the top is the old granny who runs everything. So what do the males do? The males are huge and fast. They're twice the size of the females. And they are the top predator on the planet. But they have no leadership role in this organization at all. All the leadership is through this female hierarchy. And it's not a hierarchy in the sense we mean. I mean, the leader would die for the troop. She's got way more genes in the new babies than she'd ever have in herself, right? So she would literally die for that family. So you have a leader that is completely unselfish because their biological motivation and the society's good is lined up. They're not looking for more babies like a male leader might. So opposite of chimps, the chimp alpha is there to breed. The orca alpha is there to take care of her grandchildren. So what do the males do? Well, they're bigger and faster and stronger than their sisters, and they're the best hunters on the planet, and they hunt for everybody, right? So they hunt in packs. So not the females don't hunt, but the males are bigger and faster. So what's interesting is the females go through menopause in the 30s. So what happens to the males? They die. So when the females are no longer reproductive, they transition to grannies and leaders and presidents and whatever. But there's a trade-off here. And so nobody knows this exactly, but the speculation is that this live fast, die young strategy for the males is optimal for the family and optimal for the males. Because what ends up happening is they become sexually mature in their teens. And the way they avoid inbreeding is two pods get together and swap males for a while, and the males go off with a new pod, and then they come back to mom eventually after they've done breeding. And these are the like happiest males on the planet, right? All they have to do is hunt and breed. They don't have to worry about anything else, right? But that's costly. So getting so big, so fast, apparently limits your lifespan. But that's a trade-off they're willing to make, okay? Now we could tell analogous stories for bonobos and analogous stories for elephants. All the details change, but the detail that doesn't change is the leadership is all matriarchal. Now, one can draw obvious conclusions from this, but they are dangerous conclusions. So let me just give you some counterexamples. If you look at the most murderous, homicidal mammal on the planet, this is not warfare. This is like killing your neighbors. It's meerkats, shockingly. I didn't know that, but meerkats. Okay, so they too are matriarchal. And there's a bunch of other animals that are matriarchal that are pretty nasty. I mean, obviously, ants are pretty nasty, but and they're matriarchal. So matriarchy per se is absolutely not a solution. It's matriarchy and intelligence in combination that is necessary. Okay.
this was just wonderful. I think, I mean, it seems like we need to extend this theory of architecture at societal, political, anthropological level.
Yeah.
Maybe to close the episode, I think still I want to insist on the question of advice to future students, because this tends to be a question that is very relevant to the young generations and those who are approaching the field, who are seeking inspiration in these podcasts.
Well, I think the problem is I'm a poor role model because I am way more lucky than I am smart, but I can try to abstract away from my experience, right? And particularly experience with colleagues and students, not just my own, okay? So I mean, certainly one thing I would recommend, if possible, is get an advisor who likes it when you criticize them. You want an advisor who is eager for you to knock down everything they teach you, as long as you're right. Now, and you're not going to be right all the time, but on balance, you want to be in an environment where honest, healthy criticism is embraced and done with kindness on both sides, because that's how we help each other.
John, it's been a real honor and pleasure to talk to you in this two-part episode. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And I hope we get to talk more about all sorts of things.
Thank you for listening. I hope you liked the show today. If you enjoyed the podcast, please consider giving us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts, follow us on Spotify, support on Patreon or PayPal, and connect with us on social media platforms. See you next time.